From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forums next hour, award-winning author and journalist Gary Rivlin will join us for the hour in studio to discuss his recent research book into the poverty industry, payday loans, rent-to-own, pawn shops, and instant tax refunds. It's an industry bigger in revenue than casinos and bigger than McDonald's and Burger King combined. Rivlin believes it preys upon the poor, the underclass, and the working class, and he'll join us for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. Gary Rivlin joins us in this forum hour in studio to discuss his new book, Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty Incorporated, How the Working Poor Became Big Business. The author of Fire on the Prairie, Drive-By, and The Plot to Get Bill Gates, Gary Rivlin is a two-time Gerald Loeb Award winner who has worked as a writer and a reporter for The New York Times, Industry Standard, East Bay Express, and The Chicago Reader. And who published in the New York Times Magazine, GQ, Salon, Newsweek, and Wired. And we welcome him to the program. Welcome him back to the program. Gary, good to have you here.
Thanks, Michael.
Well, this is nothing short of an expose. You did a lot of research here, and I commend you for all the research you've done. In an industry that's larger than the casino business, when you covered things in terms of revenue, you used to cover gambling, I know. And what we're talking about here are just a whole range of what we call the poverty, what you call the poverty industry. Pawn shops, payday loans, check cashing ripoffs, auto title loans, rent-to-own, subprime even. It seems pretty big canvas we got here, a pretty big tent. We've got so many different things included.
Right. When I started this, I didn't quite appreciate how many interesting ways, clever ways, abusive ways there were to get rich off the poor. And your listeners used auto finance, which is a huge industry. There are plenty of people in this country with subprime credit, you know, poor credit scores who are paying 20% interest a year, 25% interest a year for a car loan. The instant tax business, all these tax mills around Jackson Hewitt, Liberty Tax, they pop up for a month.
They even charge you for your 1040, right? For doing it, that is. But
hundreds and hundreds of dollars for doing it. They charge a lot to do your 1040. But, you know, where they really make the money, or where lenders are really making the money, is they give you an instant, in quotes, instant tax refund. So you're so desperate for cash, you can't wait the 2 or 3 weeks. They'll give it to you today or tomorrow, and they'll charge you a hefty fee for doing it. It's a multi-billion dollar a year business.
There are a lot of hefty fees and high interest rates here. And really, this pretty much takes place as you kind of trace a trajectory for us in your book because of the era of deregulation in the 80s again. I mean, it began to flourish and continues to in these hard economic times.
Right. So we've had pawnbrokers for centuries. The check cashing industry dates back to the 30s. Rent-to-own dates back to the 60s. That's the business of renting you your furniture, your television, your appliance by the week. But most of the businesses we're talking about are newer inventions. The subprime mortgage loan, subprime home equity loans, that was born in the 1980s when the federal government took away from the states the power to regulate bank lenders. In the late 1980s, you saw these instant tax mills come up, another product of deregulation. Payday lending was born in 1993. The amazing fact about payday lenders are there are as many payday lending stores in this country as there are Burger Kings and McDonald's combined. And yet, the industry only dates back to 1993 when the payday lenders started giving campaign contributions and the lobbyists worked at getting exemptions from existing state usury laws, that is, caps on the interest rates that a lender can charge.
So you're talking about a multi-billion dollar industry, about $33 billion as a crow flies, still growing.
Actually more if you include subprime credit cards, used auto. It's about $100 billion a year.
When you include those, yeah.
Right, yes.
But it goes back to the banks, really. I mean, the banks, again, when we're talking about how all this began to proliferate and mushroom into such a huge capital gain kind of thing for the industry that you're talking about, as you call it, the poverty industry, it was really the banks that provided the funding, helped them go public, and also because of the steep fees on overdrafts and because of overdue credit card payments, they provided the demand.
Exactly. And one other factor, it's the banks fleeing fleeing the inner cities. It's the banks fleeing working class communities, rural areas, that created the vacuum into which the check cashers, the payday lenders, other fringe financing companies moved, because it was the need. The big banks, and you know, let's start naming names. You look at the payday lending industry, Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, that's a partial list of the big name brand banks that helped fund the rise of the payday lenders. If you're wondering how the payday lenders went from virtually non-existent in 1993 to as large as they became, a $7, $8 billion a year industry, it's because the big banks loaned the money to these entrepreneurs who saw the big bucks to be made, giving out these payday loans, these loans of $200, $300 at a time to the working poor, those so desperate that they'd be willing to pay these really steep fees for a loan. So the banks are, you know, everywhere you look. And the big investment banks, Morgan Stanley, took public, you know, the biggest of the payday lenders, Advance America. So everywhere you look, the banks have their fingerprints on this industry.
I'm talking to Gary Rivlin, his new book again is Broke USA. And you talk about this whole business as being grossly unethical, and that you pretty much argue that that's pervasive. These deceptive practices are widespread, and you really take them on. You even make an analogy at one point to energy companies strip mining the destroyed wilderness tracts. They see themselves, many of them, I mean, you go to a Vegas convention, we'll talk about that, but they really see themselves as good guys. They're helping the poor. They, in fact, many of them say they come into these payday stations, for example, and they're happy, and they leave happy because they need the cash and they have to pay bills and so forth, and they're doing a public service. They're helping people.
Right. No, they see themselves as nobody. I entered this project, well, two things. I entered this project not sure what I thought of the payday lenders and these others who are providing short-term cash advances to the working poor. Because, I mean, what do you do if your car breaks down, the mechanic's asking for $300, you need it to get to work, and you don't have a credit card, you don't have a rich uncle you could hit up? I mean, it is a more complicated question than just saying, oh, these folks are predators, end of stories. But I really thought it was important for me to go talk not just to the critics, not just to customers, but the entrepreneurs themselves, some for their point of view, and some, I was just curious, who are these people? Who wakes up one day and say, oh, I know how I'm going to make my mark. I'm going to make my millions. I'm going to loan money at annual percentage rates that work out to 300, 400, 500% a year to the single mom with two kids making $20,000 as a chambermaid at Holiday Inn. I really wanted to meet these folks, hear their point of view, and figure out what makes them tick.
Well, you went to the convention at Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas.
The check casher, yeah.
Check cashing convention, yeah. And it's fascinating to read. You go in there and they're piping out money, that's what I want, the old Barrett Strong song, give me money and so forth. And these are credit lenders, again, who see themselves as really noble. I mean, or they kind of see themselves like Rodney Dangerfield. They get no respect.
No, it's funny. I thought of Al Franken. Was it Stuart Smiley, that character on Saturday Night Live? This sense, we're good people. I mean, every speaker after speaker would get up there, you know, the check casher from New York, the payday lender from Texas, and they would just be giving affirmations, and you know, they put on these very fancy videos just showing with pretty music. Somewhere Over the Rainbow was the background music to one of these videos, while they're showing images of people being helped, taking out a payday loan or another of these products. And you know,
they're a useful service in their own judgment, aren't they, pretty much?
Definitely they see themselves as offering a useful service. But you know, let's play devil's advocate for those who criticize the payday loan. So it's typically $15 fee for every $100 borrowed for 2 weeks. The controversial part is that works out, you do the math, to an annual percentage rate of 400%. But the payday lenders would say, like, well, if you're going to bounce two or three checks, that's going to be $30 a piece, plus you're going to ding your record, plus there's going to be other charges, no doubt, until you replace the money. You're going to be late on a credit card. What's a credit card late fee typically now? $30, $40. So it makes economic sense. You borrow a payday loan for you take $200 in a payday loan, you pay a $30 fee, and you're paying less than you would for the balance check fee. The problem is that the person who's so desperate for $200 that they'll pay these kind of fees, in 2 weeks, how are they paying that back? How are they having, on top of their usual bills, an extra $230? And so what you see people do is, you know, owe these amounts for 2 months, 3 months. So suddenly the $30 you're paying for the $200 becomes $100 you're paying for the $200, $200 you're paying for the $200, and then it doesn't make economic sense. So on paper, yes, if you could take out this loan, just it's a bridge loan for 2 weeks, pay it back, you avoid the check bounce check fee, you avoid the credit card late fee, it makes sense. In practice, what happens is the typical person owes one of these loans for months at a time, and it doesn't make any economic sense at that point.
Well, one of the people you profile, Alan Jones, we can talk about him, a guy from Tennessee, says, I get maybe, when you figure it all out and calculate it, $9 an hour. Of course, he has how many stores? 1,300 stores?
Yeah, 1,200 stores. The consumer advocates have won some victory, so he's been forced to close down in a few states. So he feels sorry for himself. He's only making $21, $22 million a year in profits, where he used to make $24, $25 million in profits before the consumer. This is just one guy with one chain.
But then you think about these rent-to-own things. I mean, a television set will cost $500. Somebody will say, okay, I'll take the television set home. I'll make payments on it. I can take it home today. I wanted a TV for my kids, whatever, to watch, we hope, things like educational television.
And PBS, then, no doubt.
What are they doing? They're paying it off for 3 years, and they wind up paying $1,500 on a $500 television set. Okay, let's get to what's being done, because you mentioned the consumer advocates. Mm-hmm. They're the only ones really who are fighting this.
There's some state legislators who have gotten involved, but yes, it's mainly the consumer advocates who are fighting this battle.
And it's a tough battle. I mean, it's an uphill battle, isn't it?
Well, I mean, one thing that makes it really hard is it's a state-by-state battle. There's legislation that's been proposed in Congress, it's never gotten anywhere, to make a national usury cap of 36%, which with a stroke of a pen would put the payday lenders out of business, or at least change their business radically.
Payday lenders have lobbyists and they have a lot of money.
And payday lenders have 12 full-time lobbyists, and that's just their trade association. Each of these big chains, the Alan Jones with his 1,200 stores, they have their lobbyists. The big banks have their lobbyists, and they're not in favor of a 36% usury cap. So there's a stalemate. It's not getting anywhere. So you have to fight state by state by state by state. And so while I was writing the book, the big fight that everyone in the industry was talking about was Ohio. Ohio is just a fantastic market, one of the top five markets for the payday lenders, for the rent-to-own industry. You can imagine they've fallen on hard economic times. The auto plants, the other heavy industry that's fled overseas, fled to the south, just been made obsolete. So unemployment's high. There's a lot of people who are doing well who are suddenly struggling, and they need the payday lenders. They need the subprime financiers of one flavor or another. So in Ohio, they decided to fight back in 2007, 2008. The consumer critics won overwhelmingly in the state legislature. The governor signed the law that would cap interest rates at 28%. Puts the payday lenders, in effect, out of business. Payday lenders turn around the next day and put a ballot initiative on the ballot that would undo what was just done. November of 2008, we're all electing a new president. In Ohio, they're also voting on this. Two-thirds of the voters vote to keep the cap, the 28% cap. This was 2 years ago. The payday lenders are still operating in Ohio. They're not charging the 390% interest like they were. Instead, they're charging 28% interest like they must by law, but they're charging a $15 application fee. They're charging a $10 credit check fee. The more aggressive are, instead of giving you your money in cash, they're giving it to you by check and then charging you a check cashing fee. And lo and behold, guess what? The fees they're charging work out more or less to the same 400% a year.
Our guest is Gary Rivlin. His book is Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty Incorporated, How the Working Poor Became Big Business. It traces that history. And of course, with the subprime mortgage crisis, you heard this, and we heard this on the air here, and you might hear this about people who are, well, preyed upon by some of these businesses that you're talking about. Well, they're victims, they're dupes, they're not savvy or smart enough, they're not informed enough. They are often leaving, as I said earlier, as they argue, with a happy smile on their face because they got the money that they needed, and in some instances – they can't. They do bounce checks. Mm-hmm. They don't make the payments back, and so forth. And so these are businesses that are taking a chance on some people, and maybe not necessarily as predatory as you're presenting them. So that argument goes. Devil's advocate. What?
Sure. Sure. So we can have an interesting argument about all those people who bought a $500,000 house on a salary good enough for a home half that size. We can have an argument about who's to blame when all those people use their house as an ATM to take the trip to Europe, to build the second bathroom, what have you. But
or because they felt that they were going to make an enormous profit but really didn't have the capital right. In the first place.
Right. I mean, that to me is, you know, morally gray ground. I mean, there's some lenders in Southern California. There's some investment banks in New York City that are to blame. But I would put some of the blame on those borrowers. I'm talking about something very different in this book. I'm talking about predatory subprime lending. I'm talking about home repair people knocking on the doors of little old ladies out of the movie Tin Man, driving them to the local mortgage broker, putting them into loans they can never afford with upfront fees of 20%, with interest rates of 22-25%. And it was about equity stripping. It was about taking the equity they had built in that home. A decade ago, a former salesman for one of these subprime lenders testified that his perfect customer was an uneducated elderly woman on a fixed income, preferably her dead husband's Social Security or pension, who had a lot of credit card debts and owned her home outright, because then he would convince her to pay off her credit card debts using a home equity loan, charge exorbitant rates despite having a pretty good piece of collateral in the home, put them in these loans that were 12, 15, 18% despite the collateral. And lo and behold, after a year, these women living on Social Security, $800 a month, whatever, would lose their home. So there was a definite predatory side to the subprime mortgage fiasco that hasn't gotten anywhere near the attention as, you know, all these middle class folks who got in over their head in part because of greed.
With respect to all the mushrooming of these pay lenders, I mean, they're convenient. They're like the liquor store. They're in the neighborhoods where the banks, as you alluded to earlier, have fled from. And because the banks have left those neighborhoods, because wages are stagnating and healthcare costs and other costs are going up, rent is going up, they become really an integral part of the neighborhoods.
Sure. I mean, the economy stopped working essentially a couple of decades ago for those who are making $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 a year as their wages are not going up, stagnating as you just said. All these other prices are going up and it gets tougher and tougher to make ends meet. And so the payday lenders, rent to own, they're all meeting the need. The pawnbrokers, the shame here is that if people just had a savings account of $500, payday lenders go out of business tomorrow. I think the maximum you could borrow against a payday lender in California is $250, thereabout. You would just be borrowing it from yourself. There'd be no need to go to a payday lender if people had just a little bit of a cushion. You don't go to the pawnbroker when you have cash in your pocket. You go to the pawnbroker when you're absolutely broke and desperate for gas money or whatever. And so, you know, that's the shame of, you know, all of these multi-billion-dollar industries. You wouldn't pay, you know, the equivalent of $1,500 in payments for a TV that would cost you $500 at the Best Buy if you could just go to the Best Buy and get it. And so it's that's kind of what drew me in part to this topic, is it's this upside down world in which people who have no money in their pocket is good for business. A favorite expression I learned while doing research on this book is a banker, they're looking for 100 people worth at least $1 million. A payday lender, they want 1 million people, none of whom have $100 to their name.
Well, you were also fascinated by who are these people.
Who are these people?
As I said, you got portraits of Alan Jones, who's one of the big-time lenders in this business, and an Ethiopian guy named Fesum Ogbazian, you call the Poverty Incorporated's Bill Gates, instant income tax refunds, Steve McKenzie, the rent-to-own guy. They all seem to have something in common. I guess in addition to avarice, they're really kind of American opportunist types, almost an archetype of that, aren't they?
Well, you know, for years I wrote about entrepreneurship here in Silicon Valley. And, you know, I'm used to ambitious people. But one thing that really struck me is the lack of self-reflectiveness about the names you just listed. Alan Jones, he's someone who's gotten very, very rich from the poverty industry. He's worth hundreds of millions of dollars, private planes, huge, whatever, $40 million a year mansion. I'm used to that writing. I got used to that writing about Silicon Valley, but you know, I should say Alan Jones is the one who invented the modern day payday lending industry. It was his idea in 1993 to start making these short term.
And then he got corporatized by a chicken king. I mean, some of these stories are really pretty colorful. The guy that you portray, Billy Webster, right?
Right. Well, Billy Webster, I mean, he's really interesting. He's actually one of the few self reflective people. So you know, the payday lending industry, it was Alan Jones. You know, dropped out of college after a year. Just took over his father's debt collection.
Actually, bought his father out.
Yeah, bought his father. He became his father's partner, and his father wasn't aggressive enough, and so he basically pushed him aside and bought him out. And the light bulb went off when he came up with this idea for a payday loan. Like, okay, bounce check fees are so high that people have an economic motivation to borrow $100, and even if they're paying at that time a $20 fee for the 2 weeks, it makes economic sense. And he just started opening stores around the country wherever he could get permission from the state legislatures to move in. And, you know, needless to say, rather quickly, there are people who are copying him. And it was a lot of, you know, family stuff, entrepreneurs, bootstraps. And this guy, Billy Webster, he was in the Clinton White House. He was Bill Clinton's scheduler. Quits after a few years and just wants to make it rich and just casting about. He doesn't care how he makes it rich. He just wants to, you know, make his money. And he discovers the payday lending industry, and he gets a wealthy partner. He's in South Carolina. He finds a rich entrepreneur who's had a lot of success in South Carolina. And, you know, he has the connections, the Clinton White House. He has the connections to get $50 million line of credit. And he just decides to go Walmart on the payday lending industry. Within 3 years, he has 1,000 of these stores across the country. He gets up to 3,000 stores, goes public. The day his company goes public, he has a net worth of more than $100 million. So needless to say, his goal of following up
his
the Clinton White
House. His goal is achieved and fulfilled. consummated, we might use that word. Broke USA is Gary Rivlin's new book. We ought to mention it's not only some of these people portrayed as mercenaries and hucksters, but Bill Brennan and Martin Eakes, who are consumer advocates and consumer advocate heroes, are also portrayed in the book. I'd like to open up the phone lines and invite your thoughts and reflections on this subject. Any questions or comments are welcome. You can join us now, toll free. The number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Again, our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also send an email to us, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Gary Rivlin, who for many years was with the East Bay Express and also the Industry Standard, and who has been a Bay Area fixture, but also is now covering a national topic, Broke USA, from Pawn Shops to Poverty Incorporated, how the working poor became big business. And let's go to your calls and find out what you have to say on this subject. TJ from Mountain View, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Quick question. Listening to this, it sounds like there are obscene profits being made off of low-income individuals. And my question is then, shouldn't in a free market competitors be coming in to force down the prices? What's the barrier to entry?
Right. I mean, you're getting at, to me, the essential moral issue here. There's nothing wrong with check cashers doing business in low-income neighborhoods. There's nothing wrong with the rent-to-center, the rent-to-own businesses going to these neighborhoods. The difference is the kind of profits they're making. The subprime credit card issuers make two or three times the profit margin compared to those who do business with conventional credit cards. The payday lending industry, until a few years ago, they're making profit margins of 25% a year. I mean, again, I covered Silicon Valley. 25% profit margin is going to get you attention even here. So you ask a natural question. With the check cashers, with the debit card issuers, actually Walmart has come in. And, you know, Walmart's, you know, everyone loves to hate Walmart. So at first, I didn't know what to think about Walmart coming into the check cashing business, but I ultimately thought it's a good thing. I mean, we need check cashers. There's 17 million or so people in this country who have no checking account.
They come, the working poor, emergencies, as we said earlier, healthcare, have to pay the rent. I mean, they really do serve a purpose. But the caller makes a good point. Why wouldn't you have more competition in this industry and cutting down lower rates and lower rates of interest?
So Walmart's moving into the check cashing industry. Last two or three years, they're in about a quarter or a third of the stores. And of course, Walmart being Walmart, they're charging much less than the corner check cashers, charging typically a few bucks to cash your check. Of course, they don't mind you walking around. They don't have to make money on that. You'd be walking around their stores with a pocket full of cash. So in some of these sectors, you're seeing competitors. But the payday lenders, I asked that very question to each of the payday lenders, Billy Webster, Alan Jones. Well, if the guy down the street's charging $15 per hundred, why don't you charge $13 per hundred? And that way, everyone will come to you and you do like Walmart does. You make less per person, but you'll make a lot more money. And they say, we charge $15 per hundred because that's what the state allows us to charge, and there has been no competitor coming in. What you are seeing with payday lending are the nonprofits and the credit unions coming in. In fact, in San Francisco, there's a group of a dozen or so nonprofits that are trying to offer an alternative product that they charge. I think the annual interest rate is 18% rather than 400%. But you know that now we're talking about a nonprofit trying to do business with a company that has a big marketing budget and all. But for some reason, there's never been competitors moving into the payday lending industry trying to undersell the payday lenders.
We'll go to a caller in Ohio, in fact, calling us from Columbus. Sean, we mentioned, well, your home state and mine. And join us on the program. Good morning.
Yeah, correct. Hi, guys. I remember those initiatives on the ballot. My comment was, Gary said something about if people were able to have savings accounts, then he thought the industry would be gone in no time. And having been around a lot of people that use these services and seen how they operate, I feel that it's more a problem with them not being able to budget and just being chronic overspenders. And I feel that even if they had a savings account, it would only be a matter of time until that was depleted and they were looking for more funds. So I feel like maybe the problem could be helped by education or, you know, some kind of training or classes for people to handle their own personal finances.
Right. Financial education, if I was going to, you know, write my list of prescriptions, that would be number one on the list. And not just for the working poor. I mean, there's a lot of middle class, upper middle class people that did some rather foolish things when it came to home equity loans, not quite appreciating that by taking out a home equity loan, you're putting your most valuable possession, your home, you know, on the line. And so I think a lot of us could use financial education. But, you know, in defense of the working poor, it's just like if you're making $25,000 a year nowadays, you got a couple of kids, it's not just budgeting. I mean, I think I'd be late on a lot of my bills because I just didn't have the money. It's really, really, really tough to keep a cushion, you know, when you're making that kind of money. So yes, financial education would help, but you know, maybe a working wage, a living wage would help as well.
Well, what about other kinds of political reform? What do we need to look at here in your judgment, or what should the citizenry be looking at?
Well, for starters, I wish we would just have the debate over measures that are being put forward, but never get in front of the full Congress. There's, you know, I mentioned a national usury cap. I mean, that's interesting. In 1978, the U.S. Supreme Court decided that it makes no difference where you as a credit card holder live. The only thing that matters is where the credit card issuer has its home base. And so suddenly Citigroup moved from New York City, its credit card operation, from New York City to South Dakota and Nevada, because those are two states that don't have a usury cap. So if listeners are wondering why they're sending their checks to their credit card companies to Nevada or South Dakota, typically, or Delaware, that's because those are three states that don't have a usury cap. And so, you know, corporations could kind of play this game and move around. I mean, California has a usury cap of 10%, but I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who are paying a lot more than that on their credit card bill because of this. If we had, in fact, it came up during the financial reform debate, but it didn't get anywhere, the financial reform debate we just had in the spring. Payday loans. There was a really interesting proposal, I thought, to let's not outlaw payday loans. Let's treat them like emergency loans. Supposedly it's for emergency. So let's say that people can't take out more than 6 payday loans in a year. Anything over that, it's not an emergency product. It's a horrifically expensive way to balance your checkbook. Again, that measure was never introduced before the full Senate. It never even got a hearing. So some of it is I just wish some of the ideas that are out there would get a hearing.
Well, we've got a lot of postings on our website. Let me read some of them. Here's Christopher, who says, these people are definitely predatory and unsavory. As an officer in the military, much of my time was spent dealing with used car dealers, payday loan hucksters, and others who took advantage of my new young enlisted who did not know any better. And many times, I had to work through the judge advocate general to take these people to court and help my people get out of their claws. For many of these places that do follow the rules that are out there, there are many others that ignore these rules. To the none the wiser, young, or uneducated. Many of these places use illegal practices and get away with it because these people taken advantage of have no idea. It was frustrating, caused many, many problems. Another listener writes, to put it into perspective, the top rate allowed for banks or others around 1975 was 18%. That was before Bill Clinton deregulated the banks. Why does it need to be more? Pure greed.
It wasn't Bill Clinton that deregulated the banks. It actually started with Jimmy Carter and then Ronald Reagan. Under Ronald Reagan, it was further deregulated. I mean, you could blame Bill Clinton for some deregulation, but not the kind that
not that she's talking about, no. Richard writes, he's mentioned the interest rate being charged to the borrower a lot. I'm curious what the net interest rate across the body of loans that the lenders are receiving. That is, how much are they losing in lending losses out of the portfolio?
Right. So a reaction to a few of those. The thing about a payday loan, it's really, really risky. I mean, all you need is a checking account and a regular check, a paycheck or a government check. But you're not offering any collateral. You're just promising that in 2 weeks you'll pay back the loan. So about 1 in 20 people default. And that does explain some of why you have to charge so much. But I'll point out that there are nonprofits making payday loans. It's the same risk, and they're charging 12% annual percentage rate, 18% APR, and still managing to make a little bit of money, if not a lot of money on this. So yes, there is risk in payday loans. Then there's something called, we haven't brought up, the auto title loan. That's using your car as collateral. And even though there's collateral, in fact, there's a very valuable piece of collateral, it's your car. These loans are typically $500, $1,000, and they're not going to loan you that amount unless you have a car worth much more than that. And so you're putting up the title to your car, and they're still charging 300% a year in interest rates because they can, because the law lets them. I mean, state by state, there's wild variations. Some states say a pawnbroker can't charge more than 60% a year annual percentage rate. Other states let them charge as much as 300% annual percentage rate. I live in New York City. 1.8% is the check cashing fee. You can't charge more than that for a payroll check. If you lived in Georgia or Arkansas, you could charge 5% of the payroll check. And 1/3 of the states in this country, there's no cap on the check.
I keep getting all these listeners saying, this is usury. How can you get away with usury? Usury is against the law, or should be against the law. Why isn't it against the law?
Well, it would be, but as I said earlier, the payday lenders spend a lot of money on lobbyists and a lot of money on campaign contributions getting exemptions from existing usury laws. Their logic is, well, this is a 2-week loan. It's an emergency loan. It's a loan for people who have no other alternative. And it was persuasive enough to convince, you know, a few dozen state legislatures around the country to grant this exemption. I will point out that Ohio essentially took away the exemption by saying we're going to not let you charge more than 28%. North Carolina took away the exemption. Arizona or Oregon. There has been a reaction, a negative reaction to the payday lenders operating in at least some states. Montana in November is going to talk about taking away their exemption. So
let me just read a couple of other remarks.
Yeah, go ahead. The military.
Well, he was just remarking about how he's had to deal with these people through through JAG, the judge.
Yeah, no, he's absolutely right. You know, it's interesting. In 2006, Congress added to the Defense Authorization Bill a prohibition against payday lenders or any of these lenders charging an enlisted person more than 36% a year interest. What was happening is the base commanders were starting to complain, like, I've got all these young soldiers who owe all this money, and there's a rule in the military that if you own more than a certain percentage of your salary, they won't put you overseas because you're distracted. They don't want that person overseas. So the base commanders were complaining.
It's a good way to avoid getting deployed, I guess.
but they came up with a rule saying you can't charge of enlisted personnel more than 36%, yet you still have a problem with the used auto of people, which, you know, again, they're charging these young recruits. They're 19, 20, 21 years old. They're getting a regular salary. They don't have much financial education.
Sometimes
and
more,
they
give them a bonus just to sign up, too. I mean, you know, so they've got some money in their pocket, and they go through it pretty quickly.
Right, right.
Here's an email from a listener named Sriram who says, I'm always intrigued when I see payday loan signs as to why anyone would go there. I have some spare money from my savings, which I would like to lend to that single mom fighting to make ends meet. I would rather lose my money to someone like that than the Bernie Madoff types. Anyway, I can locate such needy people.
Yeah, Kiva.org, though, that's more third world, where you could kind of
hang around the payday place and look for a needy-looking person. Yeah.
No, but I mean, the point behind that note is people are desperate. I mean, if you
desperate times.
If you owe $300 and you need the cash, and it's a matter of just going to this store and walking out happy with $300 cash in your pocket, you're going to do it. And how you're going to pay it back in 2 weeks, you'll worry about that in 2 weeks. So, you know, essentially that's what these businesses.
Sometimes it means putting food on a table. I mean, that's the reality of it. Here's Rudolph in Oakland who writes, you mentioned the check cashing schemes. Well, I live in a mixed income Oakland neighborhood with a corner market that is the corrupt cash sucker of the poorer residents. Besides the markups and plenty of other issues, the owner recently and illegally added a check cashing booth inside the store. It ran for about a month before a city inspector shut it down and fined the owner. Oddly enough, that same inspector wrote the very code for what type of businesses can go into residential neighborhoods. This seems like small beans comparatively, but its local level really affects the surrounding community members who are trying to improve the neighborhood. There are three banks and a legitimate check cashing business all within walking distance, and we're unfortunately close to the pay by the hour motel, so a check cashing station amongst residents was just an invitation for disaster.
Right. I mean it was interesting. I spent a lot of time in Dayton, Ohio.
Excuse me. Did you notice how many liquor stores were also in the same neighborhoods where you see check cashing stores?
Oh, I mean, yeah.
You know, they're just about as plentiful, aren't they?
Well, you look outside a military base, it's the used auto guy next to the tattoo versus next to the liquor store. But I mean, the saturation that we're talking about. So in Dayton, Ohio, I want to show one place that had fallen on hard times where you could see how this phenomena has played out. And it was just, it would just be amazing. You'd have three or four payday lenders on the same corner within 1 or 2 minute walking of each other. And at first I wondered why. And then I realized what was going on, that, you know, people go to store A so they could pay back store B, but they still owe money, so they go to store C. And so it just got to the point, or it's gotten to the point, where there's millions of people each year, a couple million people each year, who are just owing two or three or four of these stores at once, and they're going to one to pay back another and then to a third because they still owe the landlord or they still need food on the table.
It's like a Ponzi almost.
Well, and you're not getting at it. I mean, you know, you're making $20,000, $30,000 a year and you owe two or three of these stores. You're not getting out of that. I mean, there's not a happy ending typically to something like that.
No, it's better than paying the vigorish from the loan sharks
no,
on
it's
the
not.
Streets.
No,
well,
no,
some
no.
would argue because they can break your kneecaps.
Okay, but you're paying more. I mean, I tracked down, I really want to know the answer to this. I tracked down a loan shark. And, you know, what do you charge? What does a loan shark typically charge? It's 2 or 3 points a week. That works out to an annual percentage rate of 150%. Payday lenders are charging 400%. They don't break kneecaps. They don't break the rules. But I'll tell you, this loan shark, I asked him what he thought of the payday lenders. He was impressed. He was impressed that they took an essential idea that, you know, he and his ilk have been, you know, applying their craft for decades, and they turned into this corporate multi-billion-dollar-a-year industry. There are 7 publicly traded companies in this country in the payday lending industry. He was just in awe of how they built the essential loan shark idea into a mainstream business.
And doing it within the boundaries of the law, unlike what he was doing, right? As many of these, or more of these, you say, than McDonald's and Burger King combined.
Right. Actually, there were more in 2006, but because Arizona and North Carolina and Oregon, a few other states have, you know, kicked the payday lenders out. It's now about even. There's about as many payday lenders at this point, payday lender stores, as there are Burger Kings and McDonald's.
On we go. John of San Rafael, join us. Hi.
Hi. In the April 2009 issue of Harper's, there was an article on payday lending, and it was preceded by an article by Tom Gehagan on how interest rates destroyed the economy. It was called Infinite Debt. And he made a link between deregulation of banking and interest rates and the destruction of the manufacturing sector of the economy. And I think when Carter left office, manufacturing sector made up 23%. Now it's down to 8%. And supposedly, financial services were supposed to replace the manufacturing sector. Well, financial services turned out to be a real cargo cult, crony capitalist, junk economics. Anyway, I wonder if your guest could talk at all about how to get the manufacturing sector going again and make it profitable for people to invest in that and not waste money on these interest rate scams, you know, predatory lending. It's just, what's happening to this country? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right.
Yeah, well, I'm a little bit out of my realm here in, you know, offering a solution to the flight of manufacturing jobs. But I agree with the sentiment of the caller that there is a connection. That's in part why I went to Ohio and based some of the book there, that as these jobs leave, people become more and more desperate. And what's happening is, you know, formerly healthy working class communities are falling on hard times. Stores selling products are leaving, and in their place, you'll see the check casher around the corner from the pawnbroker next to the payday lender. And, you know, it really is a death spiral because, you know, it's the poor aren't poor just because they're poor. The poor get a lot of help remaining poor. And in essence, that's what my book is about, a range of industries
that help sustain poverty.
Exactly. Exactly.
There's also a lot of advertising behind this industry. I keep thinking about this phrase that you hear. It's become almost like boilerplate
Your
good credit, right?
Yeah.
With
yeah.
your good credit. And
yeah.
and some people think, yeah, I've established good credit, so why shouldn't I take advantage of that fact? Or they're saying with your good credit when what they really mean is come in the door and you've got good credit by us.
Well, though, actually the phrase I thought you were going to say for the folks I'm writing about is bad credit, no problem. I mean, those are the people. I mean, you know, this is basically, I could have called this, you know, subprime USA instead of broke USA, in that, you know, I mean, subprime nowadays, you hear subprime, you think subprime mortgage, but, you know, a payday lender is a subprime lender. Rent to own is in the subprime business. You know, these are businesses that are catering to those with damaged credit. So
those who are underwater, as they say in the mortgage world.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So you know, they are extending credit. I mean, there is this sense, and getting back to the Harper's piece that the previous caller just brought up, there is this sense that we should extend credit to everyone because that's fair. It's like, you know, I think there's a human right for housing, healthcare, and food, but credit, I mean, you could get – these are dangerous products. And what bothers me about the payday lenders is how aggressively they're pushing this. There are some chains that will call you up if you haven't been in their store in 2 months to try to induce you to come back. Hey, this is an emergency product. You don't – you're not trying to induce people to come. And they're creating the demand. They're not
Aren't
just
they also looking
demand.
For people who have a lot of credit card debt? I mean, they almost – when they see credit card debt clustering, this is like a magnet for them.
Right. So not the payday lenders, but those – you know, the consumer finance world, household finance, city financial. Yeah. There are businesses that they buy lists of, you know, working class folks who have a ton of credit card debt and at the same time own equity in a home. And then they try to sell you a very expensive home equity loan. You know, don't pay the individual credit card. You're paying too much for the credit card. You could pay less. Instead of 25% interest, you could pay 15% interest in a home equity loan. But there are, of course, all these fees. And now you've just put your home on the line.
And we go to more of our callers. We'll go to San Jose. Greg, join us. You're on.
Yeah. First of all, you guys, this usury thing, you have to understand, Ronald Reagan dropped usury laws when he was president. All right? So that took care of that right there. And I know it's a little bit of history, and America's not too good on history, but there you go. Two, 8 years of Bush destroyed the working families of this country. The middle class is a joke. So all you have left are, quote, the working poor. But if you don't have a job, you only qualify for the poor part. Okay? Now, in my case, I just got in a truck to go over here to get a payday loan. And we're on NTR. You guys are talking about this. only because another dork Republican, Arnold Schwarzenegger, turned off the Saturday services for unemployment interviews so people can receive benefits. And so they changed it to from the 4th of September to the 13th. Well, I only have $100 to go for this week because I mailed my statement on Sunday. And now I'm looking at 3 weeks. But they changed it to the 9th, thank God. So I'm still kind of stuck. So we keep going about this. Unless a guy has a job, we're poor. If people want to vote these Republicans back in, it's going to be just a fun fest. And their rich friends, the 2% of the population, get a $700 billion a year tax break at that check. So I know, guys.
Now, good luck to you, Greg. I hope you find something. And thanks for the call, making a contribution to this program, despite the fact that he's penniless. What are we going to say, Gary?
Well, I mean, you know, his point about, you know, Ronald Reagan got rid of the usury laws, I mean, he's right to an extent that, you know, under Reagan, though it started under Carter, to be fair, they took away usury caps on home loans, on real estate loans. There's still usury caps for small loans, but, you know, it's true. There is no longer a usury cap applied to home loans. And, you know, Greg's bigger point that, you know, he's in a bad situation right now is just going to payday lender. I mean, keep in mind that hard economic times are boom times for the businesses I'm writing about. The payday lenders who are publicly traded, they have to give their numbers every quarter. They're having more people per store come in. The rent to own, they're having more traffic. They're getting new customers because there are all these people who never in a million years thought they'd go to a payday lender or to a rent to own store or to a pawn shop. Pawn shops, man, pawn stocks, there are three publicly traded pawn companies. Pawn stocks are up 50% in the last 2 years. I mean, it's been a really lousy 2 years for the stock market, but it's up 50%. Pawnbrokers are just, you know, going through the roof. All these people bringing in their flat screen TVs or the expensive baubles they bought during good times are now desperate. So these are great times for hard economic times. And to go along with Greg's point, you know, the longer hard times last, the better it is for the range of industries I'm writing about.
Well, Greg's other point, and by the way, I never thought I'd be quoting Gone with the Wind, but it reminded when I was a kid, I read Gone with the Wind, and Rhett Butler says, these are the times when you make the most money, either the best of times or the worst of times,
right,
economically. Dickens put it another way, of course. But I'm struck just by the sense of how people are struggling now and struggling more and more, which means the proliferation of this industry. This is really a growth industry.
Right. And, you know, I mean, not all of them, like, check cashers aren't doing as well because there's unemployment is high, so people aren't getting paychecks. So it's not every single one of these industries, but most.
We get another caller on. Eric, you're on Forum. Good morning.
Hi, Michael. This is Eric Weaver. I'm the CEO of Opportunity Fund. I was on your show a couple months back talking about microfinance. And I wanted to just pick up on a couple things Gary said and offer at least a small way people can help with this. One is, he mentioned Kiva. You can make loans in the U.S. on Kiva now. We're one of the U.S. Kiva partners, so you can go there and make a loan to Bay Area entrepreneurs. Secondly, on the subject of savings, we have a program called an individual development account, and we've helped 3,000 families, very low-income families, about $24,000 annual income, show that they can save money after they receive a financial education course. And we're launching a new program called Start to Save, and I really encourage people to check that out with us. We're going to help families build up a $1,000 emergency fund precisely so they can avoid falling into these kind of financial traps. So there's some of us out there working hard to try to...
Yeah, Eric, why don't you give the name of your company one more time on your website?
Sure. It's Opportunity Fund, and it's opportunityfund.org.
Okay.
And I really appreciate everything Gary said. He's doing great work.
Yeah, and thank you for the call. Good to hear from
you.
Thank you. And let me get another caller on here. David, hi.
Yes, hello. Thank you for having me. My question before I ask it is something I like to put on the table, and that is if this is not a new problem. The problem has gone on through about 3,000 years of history. And I'm not going to go back through 3,000 years of history, but just think at one point where papal bulls were put out to ban the number period, and yet there was ways that were found around. Why? Because everything is being put out as a Band-Aid. We have this problem. Let's show you the people who are doing it. And let's see if we can find a way to ameliorate it to some degree, but not attack the underlying underroot problem. And I don't find anyone who's ever come forward to this date attacking, as I said, the underroot problem of the people who are put in that position in the first place. If they're not put in that position, that's the only way you're really going to root out the problem.
Okay, David, I thank you for the call.
Well, I mean, to me, one... Big deal. I mean, he's right. This has been a problem dating back to, you know, thousands of years. But I think what I'm writing about, I think what's changed is the massification, you know, kind of the Walmart effect, that these businesses aren't just ma-and-pa businesses where, you know, you could get, drive a Cadillac, buy the wife a mink stole, have a nice house rich. We're talking about people who have figured out how to bring in MBAs and the most aggressive, sophisticated marketing and turn these businesses into multi-billion dollar businesses.
We're running very short on time, but what about that caller, Greg, who said it's all about partisan politics, it's Republicans to blame?
You know, I mean, Billy Webster, the biggest guy in the payday lending, is a Democrat.
I want to get that on the record. Both are taken from the lobbyists. And thank you, Gary Rivlin. The book, again, Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty Incorporated, How the Working Poor Became Big Business. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.